accession number 28361, reel 18.
General Julian Thompson, reel 18.
I think right about that time there was a lot of internal trouble in Indonesia, and there was a Chinese minority that were being attacked.
Yes.
There were massacres going on. Did you have any plans to deal with the consequences of those disorders? Because often they generate trouble around
I don't think there were any plans, none that I was aware of, and I would have been aware of them had there been. I don't think there was. I think it actually took a lot of people by surprise, the events in Indonesia.
Yes.
That's the impression I got, because sitting where I was, and I was actually at the centre of it, there didn't seem to be any end to confrontation sort of on the radar screen, and all the various sort of rumours were being sorted out who's going to take over from who, and it was, as far as we were concerned, it was going to go on forever, and it just sort of just fizzled out and stopped very quickly.
Mm. Well, I mean, often you get mass movement of refugees and so forth, when there are troubles.
But of course it was contained because the refugees couldn't get off there was no way they could get off the islands, as it were. Mm. It was too far for them to go to anywhere that it affected us. Mm.
You were mentioning special needs for the claret operation, special kit in particular. What kind of special kit was needed for those deep penetration?
Well, they needed, for example, the new a lot of people wanted AR-16s, the Armalite, which we had ahead of the Americans actually. That those were coming in. Some of the sort of jungle navigation stuff was required. They were sort of lights, strobe lights, and all that sort of stuff. Mm. I mean, it wasn't big stuff, but it was little, especially. Somebody said, well, if we only we had one of those, we could do so much better.
What were the strobe lights used for?
Helicopters. It was a light that used
went
to
on and off.
It flashed very very. It was an American invention, and it was very very visible, and it was an emergency landing beacon.
The Armalite. Why was the Armalite favoured for these?
Well, because it's much lighter than the SLR.
Yes.
And of course, it also fired automatic, which the SLR didn't. Mm. And it was regarded as being the weapon to use in the jungle.
Where did you get them from?
They were a buy, and I can't remember how many we bought, but we had them ahead of the Americans, actually.
Mm. Were you at this time aware of what was going on slightly to the east in the old French Indochinese territories?
Yes, because the CETO plans were very much for the defence of Thailand.
Yeah.
I think that was the only plan that stayed, because CETO used to involve defence of Laos and Cambodia, and that had rather gone by the window by 1966. Mm. So that the main plans were defence of Thailand, if they came through Cambodia or Laos and through the various passes, the Lao Bao Pass and the other one, I can't remember the names of them now, and invaded Thailand. And though I actually then never went to Thailand, I went to Thailand later when I was working with the chiefs of staff as part of this part of continuation of the CETO planning. But we were very much aware, and of course it was really beginning to grind by 1966. I mean, the Americans were in there full time, and we were of course very interested in what they were doing and what lessons there were to be learnt on a tactical point of view, what was coming out of there. And of course one of our principal sources of information were the Australians, who were beginning to get involved. Of course we had Australians working in our headquarters as well, in the far off. In fact, a chap in the next office to mine was an Aussie, and Aussies who'd either served in Vietnam or were going to used to come to the headquarters and sort of bring us up to date. And in fact I was one of the team sent from Far Elf to observe the Australian Task Force final workup exercise before they went to Vietnam. Mm. And they did a 6-week exercise in a training area in Queensland, which we eventually went to, actually. Yeah. Not the Canungra training area, but another training area, which had been specially set up for this exercise, which we used about a year later. And they flew the whole task force in there with a huge amount of chaps to do enemy who'd spent months digging bunker positions and creating Viet Cong and North Vietnamese army type positions. Yeah. And then they put this task force, it was actually a brigade, they called it a task force, it was 3 battalions plus, through its paces over a period of 6 weeks. They really put them through the mill, and we were lucky enough to be able to send some observers, and I was one of them. I went to observe this exercise.
What did you take away from that then? What did you notice particularly?
Well, I think that the sort of scale of it compared with Borneo, which by that time had stopped, this must have been sort of autumn of 66, I suppose, and the huge scale of it, and the fact you were fighting, I mean, against the North Vietnamese, you were fighting a conventional enemy. You know, the enemy threat was far, far bigger than the threat that we'd faced in Borneo, and the sheer scale, the size of their fire bases, and the whole business of the fire base concept, and how they intended to operate. I mean, they had APCs. The Aussies had APCs, and of course they used their APCs to great effect in one of the battles they had there.
Mm. Did you believe in the fire base concept and its implications?
I mean, I think it was. Funnily enough, we took it up as well. I mean, we started using the firebase concept. We never actually used it in battle, but we used it in other exercises and training that I got involved in later. But I think it was okay. I think the problem with, I mean, we're just talking about Vietnam. We could talk about it all afternoon. I think that the problem was that there was this sort of go out and bash everybody and then back to the firebase mentality, which didn't actually work, really.
It's a rather blunt instrument, isn't it?
Mind you, you see, I think it was a blunt instrument against the Viet Cong, but it was not a blunt instrument against the North Vietnamese Army. Now, there were really two wars in Vietnam. There was the one, the guerrilla war, and then there was the one against what was a formed regular army, the North Vietnamese Army. But the Aussies, of course, were going to operate in the south of Vietnam, and very much against Viet Cong. I don't think the NVA ever got down that far. And they were very successful because they were there all the time. They insisted on keeping that TAOR the whole time, so they got used to it, and it began to get a sort of Aussie flavour to it. And I think they had it fairly well buttoned up, actually. Because of that.
But also, I mean, the American Army had developed this idea of the firebase, hadn't they? And the Marine Corps don't seem to have had the same sort of approach.
Well, they did with Khe Sanh, of course. They had
that was different because they were facing a direct assault.
That was a direct assault, yes.
Yes,
I don't know what else one would have done. I don't know how else one could have played it. I mean, in a way, if you were protecting a sort of a village, you then had to protect it, and the threat got more, so you put more stuff in to protect it. So you willy-nilly sort of built it up into a fire base almost by default, in a way.
I think the Marines believe more in relying upon small unit infantry tactics than artillery firepower.
Yes, I think they did, but they also used artillery a hell of a lot.
Well, as and when they thought it was appropriate.
Appropriate,
but,
yes.
The main effort, I think, their idea was
small tactics,
and lots of aggressive patrolling.
Yes,
with backup when it was needed.
Sure,
coming in by helicopter if necessary.
Yeah, I think they did. Of course, that predicates a highly trained person.
It does.
Because you can't get away with it if you haven't.
Highly trained and highly motivated.
Highly motivated, exactly. But when you're up against the North Vietnamese army, you know, in sort of divisional size formations, then you've got to try and do it in a different way.
Well, then you bring in the air power.
Then you bring in the air power.
You use your own armour, don't you?
Yes, right.
And you fight as conventionally as the terrain and the
allows you. Yeah.
Yes, which is what they did. But in between times, when they're not facing formed units, and you're dealing with a population that's partly up in arms against you, and mostly undecided.
Quite. The firebase wasn't necessarily such a good idea. But we picked it up, you know.
Yes.
From them.
Mm. Well, it's convenient to think that you can win your wars by expending ammunition rather than putting men
in
serious risk, isn't it?
Sure. And we did pick it up from them and used it. And I mean, I'll come on to it later, but it was a sort of mindset that I, as brigade major of the brigade, had to fight against when the brigade came back from the Far East.
Yes.
And, you know, we had to sort of radically rethink, jig our whole ideas. Mm. But to go on the point, we were definitely interested in what was happening away to the northeast of where we were.
Mm. Were the Americans providing you with a lot of information through the CETO net?
We used to get briefings from the Americans.
Yeah.
And quite a lot of stuff came down, but not very highly classified, because, of course, you know, the CETO stuff was also going to other members of CETO, who didn't want to read it.
Mm. How did you get on with the Thais when you were dealing with them?
Hardly at all. I mean, when I dealt with them from the mod, I was dealing with Americans, not Thais.
But weren't they involved in CETO when you were?
Oh, right, yes. But I didn't have face-to-face contact with them at all, because we were sitting back in Phoenix Park just looking at the plans.
All right. And the business of Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Was there a thing, you know, what do people think was likely to be the outcome of the travel around?
Well, I
Hong
think
Kong?
The problem that people feared was that it would get so out of hand that the Chinese would say, well, if you can't control the colony, we will. And they'd move in and take over. That was the fear.
Do you think that was a realistic prospect?
Oh, I think so. I think the perception was that you know, they'd gone crackers.
Yes.
You know, all this sort of flower power and all that, whatever it was. You know, what was it? You know, the sort of little red books and all that sort of stuff. I mean, they'd gone absolutely balmy. And well, so they were not to be relied upon to act in a rational way.
Well, there were violent incidents even in London involving staff from the Chinese embassy.
That's right.
But was there any trouble in Singapore?
No, Lee had them absolutely screwed down. I mean, there was no trouble in Singapore at all. Mm. I mean, Lee's first IA, if any trouble sort of popped above the parapet, was to send in... He had a particular bunch of sort of CRS equivalent, who were actually Gurkhas, ex-British Army Gurkhas, who he'd recruited when their time was over. And the Gurkha police in Singapore would go in and sort out anybody.
What did you do then when you finished in Far East Land Forces?
What happened was almost my last task in Far East Land Forces was would lead me into my next one, because at that stage we were then planning, or the Aden withdrawal was taking place.
Yes.
And we're now talking about the end of 1967. Mm. And it was going to be finally stage managed from the Far East, because somebody had to sort of do it while they were all pulling back. You had to, as it were, be in charge, because they were going to be trickling back. And so the final stages were going to be masterminded from the Far East side. So I was sent with a team of people to put in our input to the withdrawal from Aden plan. So in June or something in 1967, I was sent there. We flew there via Karachi into Aden, and got involved in the final planning. And in fact, we arrived just after the uprising. Remember, there was that uprising where there was
the crater.
We arrived just after the crater due. And the reason I was particularly interested was because I was going back to regimental duty, and I was going to 40 Command, and I was going to get involved in the Aden withdrawal. So I was actually going to go and plan what I was going to do.
What were you going to be in 40 Command?
Well, I was, to my slight horror, was going to be sent there to do another tour as an adjutant. Not because I joked that I had to be sent there twice because I did it so badly the first time, but because the CO decided that he wanted an adjutant who'd been to Staff College, which was unusual. But I'd asked to go back to regimental duty, and my wish was granted, but not to what I wanted to do. But I couldn't complain.
Presumably you wanted to command a company.
I wanted to command a company, and I was pretty pissed off at not going to do that. But anyway, I went back as the adjutant. But they said you commanded a company twice, or one and a half times, once in Aden and for 6 months in 40 Commando, so you've done your whack.
But you hadn't commanded a rifle company, had you?
No, but I'd commanded a company in a rifle role in Cyprus.
Yes.
So that's what they...
They reckon that was the same thing?
That was what they said.
Then you should have been in line, presumably, to be 2IC of Commando.
No, because I was still a captain. I was only a captain still. So I then... went to Aden to do this planning, and then found myself back in 40 Command and getting on board an LPH to go and conduct the withdrawal from Aden.
Carry out the plan. What was the plan that you made then?
I was doing the logistic bit of it,
yes.
Which was sort of how you offloaded stuff onto ships and what the requirements were for the actual covering force, and the covering force consisted of a commando group embarked in the LPH and a Royal Fleet auxiliary with all the sort of necessary stores, and one stage two aircraft carriers with buccaneers and buccaneer strike aircraft. What happened was that everybody was flown out by RAF aircraft from Cormaxa back to UK, except for the final commando out, which withdrew by helicopter back to the LPH, and the last man, you know, off turned out the lights, and then just left, and then to allow sort of mayhem to start, which it did, of course.
What was the situation when you were out there doing your planning?
It was. I mean, Crater was still in the hands of... I didn't think... Oh, what's his name? Had marched into Crater at that stage.
Mitchell.
So it was pretty tense, actually. You know, what was going to happen?
Was there a lot of violence going on when you were there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I didn't see it, but it was going on.
Where were you then? Were you in Little Aden?
No, I was sent to... We lived in the headquarters in Steamer Point. You know, in a deserted quarter that had been abandoned by its former owners.
Yes. So there was trouble. The rebels were effectively dominating Crater at that stage.
They were dominating Crater at that stage.
What was the status of the police at that time? Had they mutinied?
As far as I remember, they'd mutinied. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So they mutinied before you arrived.
Yes. The whole thing blew up. Just before we left,
yes,
and we had sort of arrived, and it was all happening, and everyone was playing it very close to the chest, you know, what they were going to do.
Did you have to take any special precautions for the security of your headquarters, Steamer Point?
No, because I mean, I was a visitor.
Yes,
me and there was only three of us went across. There was a naval officer. From the Joint Headquarters in Singapore, there was another Royal Marine Colonel who was in the Joint Headquarters in Singapore, and there was me as the logistician. So we were guests of the headquarters in Aden, so we were totally in their hands. You know, we just did as we were told.
So what was the outline of the plan then? That that you had to fill in? Everyone was going to go.
Everyone
would fly out.
Everyone would fly, and we had to then.
And the commando would hold the airfield.
The commando would hold the airfield,
yes.
And then would backload to the ships. The bit that I was there for was the backloading of stores before all that happened. You know, the shipping it out from Aden back to either UK or to
Far East.
The Far East. You know, the bits we wanted we took, the bits we didn't want went to wherever.
So and would this backloading be done entirely by helicopter, or would it?
No, it was done by merchant ship and RFA.
Came down to the docks.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I wasn't involved in it. All I did was I said, you know, we want this, this, and this. Mm. So we'll arrange to get it back. We don't want that, and that. And
so that can go off early.
And that can go off early if you want to. And that we don't want. You can leave it behind.
What did you need to keep, particularly to maintain the viability of the covering force while you were?
Well, the sort of stuff you had to leave was wire, ammunition, food, things like radio batteries and spares to keep them operating while they were still there. Because the actual wind down went on for quite a long time. I mean, we're talking about weeks rather than hours, and so. They pulled everything out of Little Aden, for example, into Big Aden, as we called it. And so you needed to make certain that they didn't backload stuff so fast that somebody turned around and say, I haven't got a battery for my radio. Or can I have some ammunition, please? Or what about some fuel? So it was all the sort of combat supplies. It was making certain that the rundown of combat supplies had been coordinated so that the bits that we wanted came to us, and the bits we didn't want went somewhere else, were either left behind, like old vehicles that weren't worth pulling back, or were sent back to UK, shipped back to UK.
So, essentially making sure that there's a coordination between the phase lines of the contracting perimeter and the availability of what is necessary, and getting out anything that's valuable that you don't need.
Sure. I mean, the main work on that, of course, was done by the logisticians in the Middle East headquarters. I was just putting in the Far East input.
For the commander?
For the whole of the Far East theatre. So when I said I was having to plan the withdrawal, I was planning a withdrawal which I was going to take part in, but I was doing things that were nothing to do with what I had to do when I got back there in the covering force.
Right.
Sorry, I didn't make that clear. What I was... but I was also... saying things like, from the logistic point of view, because the covering force will be on its own out at sea, it'll need X, Y, and Z on board the supply ships, you know, ammunition, battle batteries, spares, etc., in order to support itself, either while it's sitting around doing nothing, or if it has to go in and fight. To maintain it while it's fighting.
And then while it's being recovered back to ship.
While it's being recovered back to ship.
All that would have to be helicopterable.
All that would have to be helicopter or landing craftable.
Ah, yes. Where were the landing craft going?
The landing craft were the Bulwark carried four landing craft, four LCAs or LCVPs as they were called.
And were they going to go into docks or into a beach?
No, they'd go into a beach.
Had you chosen the beach?
Oh, yes. Because we'd wrecked all the beaches. The task of the covering force was A, if the final commando wharf got into a fight and got bogged down and couldn't extract itself, then we'd go in and help them.
Clear the way.
Help them hold off the screaming hordes while they withdrew and then withdraw with them. But the main task, which we spent something like 2 months hanging about off Aden after it was over, after the withdrawal was over, was withdrawing UK and friendly nationals from Aden and Little Aden. And there were quite a lot of them, actually, because the whole of the British expat workforce in the Little Aden refinery was still there. There was the British ambassador was there. And so that was the task. That we had, and so it was a rescue mission. So we had wrecked beaches and landing sites where we'd go and pick these people off. And you know, how did you go in and land on a beach which we all knew because we'd all swum from it, from Little Aden in the past? And then how do you sort of bring in the people from all the bungalows and houses they lived in on the oil refinery patch, as it were, and get them down to the beach safely. If there was sort of ravening, chaps outside waving AK-47s and trying to kill them.
Did these ravening hordes actually
materialise? No. It was a. I think there was over fevered imagination on part of the planners who thought that the first thing that the agencies would do once we'd gone is sort of kill all the expats.
They were assuming the worst case.
They were assuming the worst case. Yeah. I mean, the whole place had gone to complete chaos. I mean, remember, the police had mutinied, the army had mutinied.
Just the federal...
The federal regular army had mutinied. The officers in the army and some of the soldiers had taken sides on... Because there were two lots of people. There was Flossie and the other lot, whose name I can't remember, who were the two groups that were in rebellion, as it were, against the British. It wasn't cohesive. There were two lots of people with different agendas who hated each other as much as they hated us. And therefore, as soon as we left, we could see there'd be a big night of the long knives as they sorted it, and as indeed there was. I mean, massacres in Crater while they all chopped each other up. And the worry was they'd start chopping up the expats as well.
Did you have any contact with the expats?
We had contact through the embassy.
Oh, yes. What did the expats think of their prospects?
I think they were pretty relaxed, actually,
they were.
Quite frankly, yeah.
Did they think that the Aidanese would just sort out each other and leave them alone?
I think so. Which is what happened, of course.
How long did it take you to make these plans and get them jacked up?
Well, the plans for the withdrawal of the kit, it was just a question of fitting in with what had been decided out there. So all I had to do was go and say, well, look, what we want is this, and when can we have it? And when can we bring ships in to take it away? Or airplanes in to take it away? So it didn't actually take very long. I mean, I can remember it took 2 or 3 days, something like that.
How long were you there then in Aden?
Well, I was then. We were off Aden for in the planning bit. I was there for about 3 or 4 days.
And then you were you then.
Then I flew back to the Far East.
Back to the Far East.
Because I was still working for Far Elf. I was still on the books of Far Elf. So I went back to the Far East with the rest of the guys. And then either on our way back or after we got back, we then heard about how old Mitch had gone in there and sorted out Crater. And then. Not long after that, I then handed my job over in Far Elf and went to up the road to join Forty Commando.
And they then sailed off.
We then embarked in Bulwark.
Yes.
And sailed across to Aden, and arrived while the withdrawal was going on, and when it was successful, we waved goodbye to. 42 Commando in HMS Albion, which they'd withdrawn to. She disappeared, and we stayed as the cover force
offshore. And you didn't have to actually go in.
No.
Inland.
No.
How far offshore was?
How far off? Well, we stayed out of sight of Aden. We were out of sight of land over the horizon. And we were there for a couple of months. In fact, the only sort of light relief we had was going to Mazira Island, because we were tied by a sort of string off the end as to how far, how quickly we could get back.
Yeah.
And the string sort of lengthened as time went on. And the CEO arranged for us to go and have training period in Mazira Island.
What was there on Mazira?
There was an Air Force base in Mazira then, in those days. It was a staging post. And there was an airfield.
And trooping out to the Far East, wasn't it?
Yes, Mazira was a diversion for Bahrain. And the other thing it had was the most wonderful shellfish, which used to be caught, and the RAF used to ship them home to their messes in UK in iced containers. The Bahrain, of course, was still going because the rump of HQ Middle East moved to Bahrain and became BFG, British Forces Gulf.